Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Ron Rash on his latest novel, The Caretaker. Ron Rash is the author of the Penn Faulkner Award finalist and New York Times bestselling novel Serena, in addition to the critically acclaimed novels The Risen, Above the Waterfall, The Cove, One Foot in Eden, Saints at the River, and The World Made Straight, 5 collections of poems and 7 collections of stories, among them Burning Bright, which won the 2010 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, Nothing Gold Can Say, a New York Times bestseller, and Chemistry and Other Stories, which was a finalist for the 2007 Penn Faulkner Award. And today we're here to talk about Ron's latest novel, which is The Caretaker. Ron, welcome to Little Atoms.
It's good to be with you.
First of all then, Ron, would you tell me how you would describe this novel?
It's a novel about, I think in some ways, hard-won hope. Hard-won. It's in some ways, my most hopeful novel. And I've kind of known sometimes as a pretty dark writer, but this one, I kind of wanted to, William Faulkner once said that he believed most people were a little bit better than their circumstances ought to allow. And it's about, for the most part, most of the people in the book striving to be a little bit better, trying to rise to the occasion, to do the right thing.
So you've mentioned that it's maybe a little bit lighter, but how does this novel relate to your wider body of work?
I think it's interesting. So many of the writers I love seem in their final books that they kind of want to give a little bit of, almost like a gift, a little bit of hope, I think, to the audience. I think of William Faulkner and his last book, The Reavers, is in many ways his most comic, you know, lighter book. I think of John Cheever with Falconer, the hopefulness of that ending. And we know that maybe The Tempest wasn't the last play that Shakespeare wrote, but I think late in his career, after, you know, the utter darkness of Lear and some of the other tragedies, that novel, I mean, or that play has a kind of hopefulness that I think sometimes it's interesting to me that I think sometimes writers want to kind of give us that late in their careers. And so that was kind of, as I started working on the novel, I realized maybe that was part of what I wanted to do in this one.
So this novel there are 3 main characters, and we're going to talk about each of them in turn, but we're going to start with Jacob Hampton. So tell us something about who he is.
He's a young man. He's been raised in a family that in this small town community is prominent. And he's in many ways, a very admirable young man, but he's a little bit impulsive. And he falls in love with a younger woman, a girl, almost 16 years old, and then rather rashly elopes with her. Then more problems ensue because he's conscripted into the Korean War. And I think he's that. And the novel actually starts with him. And I did that on purpose because I really wanted him and the reader to feel like I'm going to put him under a dire enough situation where he really kind of gets to the core of who he is and what matters to him.
Tell us something about both his parents, Cora and Daniel, and their background, his family background.
Well, his parents, and this is very important to me. I never want my characters to be one-dimensional. I mean, because I don't think that's being true to humans. I think we all are contradictory. We all have our impulses. But they're people who are very aware of their place in the community. They see themselves as a little bit of noblesse oblige. But they've also really done some commendable things in the 1930s during the Depression. They run a sawmill and a store. So they've helped a number of families in a time when no one else could or was willing to. So they've done a lot of good. But they also have a very strong sense of what they think is best for the community and ultimately for their son. So when Jacob decides to elope with this young woman who is from what they consider an inferior class, they go to pretty horrific levels to try to prevent it from continuing, the relationship, the marriage. And that to me was really interesting. And I didn't really get into that part of the novel until later. I didn't want them to come off as demonic, but certainly I think their actions are really frightening, how far people will go and doing it in their minds justified, because they see it as an act of love. They're saving their son from this relationship, this marriage that he will ultimately regret.
And there's loss in their family as well.
Yes. And I think that's I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's a very important part of it. And I think it makes them more human. They've had two daughters, and the daughters have died before Jacob comes a few years after that. So they've already lost two children. And now they're dealing with losing Jacob, if not in war, in this relationship, because they've alienated him and his wife Naomi so much that they feel that, in a sense, they've lost their last child. And I hope that makes the reader in some ways more sympathetic to them, even as they're doing these things that I think the reader's going to define at times reprehensible.
There's a short section at the beginning of Jacob in Career, which it's short, but it's very vivid. Tell us something about his experiences in Career, but also just about writing this section, about researching it.
Well, in the United States, the Korean War is just not talked about much. It's kind of the forgotten war. But I had a relative, an older relative, who fought in Korea. He was a Marine, and he was in some of the fiercest fighting. And so as I was growing up, I would hear stories about what that was like. And I just remember the things that he talked about was the ferocity of the fighting, but also how cold the Korean climate was, even for someone such as himself who grew up in the Appalachian Mountains. And I wanted that scene. I just wanted that scene to be as dramatic and vivid as possible. I wanted it to be a scene where I think we see Jacob in a sympathetic light, because I think in some ways, if we don't have that opening scene where we see him that way, but I really wanted to really give a sense of what it would be like to fight in Korea and to as I say, just get a scene as vivid as possible to draw the reader in into the novel and to start caring about certain characters.
So tell us something about Naomi then. Who is she?
Well, she's a young, obviously very young. She's comes from a family that poor, but they are, her mother's died, farm family. She's not educated. She had to quit school in third grade, which would not have been that unusual at this time, 1951 United States, particularly in a rural, very rural area. But she's bright. She's attractive and has grown as she's working as a maid in this hotel. She and Jacob, the young man, fall in love. But she has her own flaws. Certainly, I think her motivations at times are a little bit suspect, even though I think we ultimately sympathize with her. But she has certain strengths about her, certain illusions that she will reveal. But I hope she's a memorable character. That there's certain moments where she shows her immaturity. I mean, she's only 16 years old, but I think there's a certain strength there.
So Jacob's parents obviously think that she is not good enough for their son. And they have, I mean, they're a well-to-do family. And as far as they're concerned, although, I mean, it does sort of turn out that, you know, Naomi's family are more respectable than they might seem. But they think this is a poor family from another state and therefore it's not good enough. But she's also looked down upon by other people in the town as well. Tell us something about why she's rejected by the townspeople as well.
Well, this is interesting because I think one of the interesting things about Americans is that we don't like to talk about class, but it's very much a part of American culture. And even in this small, you know, fairly rural area, small town in Appalachia, there's a sense of class divisions. She's seen as certainly, I think, being a lower class, but also as a kind of interloper. I mean, in a sense, it's almost as if the town feels like, well, Jacob, being from this, you know, the most prominent family in the community, should marry someone from within the community. So she's an outsider that way. The fact that she's not from an economic level, societal level, adds to that. So I think that those things kind of show sometimes the ugliness of particularly in sometimes small towns, you know, that sense of being insular and not wanting someone from the outside to be part of it.
So she comes from just over the border in Tennessee. Her father has a small holding, a small farm there that he's working. And this is, the novel is set in 1951, but this farm feels like, in a lot of ways, you know, that sort of life would not have changed for hundreds and hundreds of years. Obviously, you know, not necessarily in America, but thinking back to just like, you know, European peasant stock working the land. What would life have been like on a small holding like this when Naomi was growing up in the 40s and 50s?
It would have been very much the way I depicted it. Actually, my mother's family were farmers, and farmers about the same economic status as Naomi's family or her father's holdings. So it would have been, there would have been a couple of crops that would bring in some money, very often a small tobacco allotment. But a lot of the food would be just for the family's sustenance. I mean, that's one thing I remember in my childhood was going out and digging up potatoes, picking string beans. There would be some livestock. So these people were very self-sufficient. They were able to get through times where, you know, even if they did not have, they had very little money, they were still able to sustain themselves through what they grew, the animals, you know, that they husbanded.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Ron Rash, and we're talking about his new novel, The Caretaker. And Ron, well, let's talk about the caretaker of the title. The titular character of the novel is the third of our triumvirate of characters, Blackburn Gant. Tell us something about who he is.
He is the caretaker of the town's cemetery, the community cemetery. When he was a child, he contracted polio that caused him partial paralysis in a leg and also facial paralysis on one side of his face. And because of that, he's become an outsider. He's very self-conscious about his appearance and has actually become the community, in a sense, has given him the job of being the caretaker of the cemetery. So he, since the age of 16, he's been up there living in a cottage beside there. He caretakes, he digs the graves, looks after the cemetery and the church. So he's living in a sense in the world of the dead in the novel. His one friend has been Jacob, who's been very kind to him as they were growing up. But now Jacob has gone to Korea and has asked Blackburn to look after Naomi. And so in a sense, he's already now not only the caretaker of the dead, but also the living.
I think people nowadays have forgotten polio and its impact. But what would have been the impact of polio on a small town like this in the 1950s?
Oh, it would have been tremendous. I was alive when the vaccine, the salt vaccine started to be given out. I can remember that. But I can also remember a number of people, including children, who contracted polio. And there was a great fear. I mean, people would, they weren't sure about how it'd be transmitted. Very often people were afraid to go to swimming pools, places maybe that were public. So, yeah, and I can remember the fear of it. And I thought in a way that tied in a little bit to COVID. But I think the polio epidemic is something that was so frightening. And I think because so often it happened to children and a child could sometimes die, sometimes be paralyzed, sometimes just long-term health problems such as Blackburn.
Well, it's funny you compared it to COVID because obviously, like, people don't seem to like vaccines anymore. So maybe, maybe one day polio will be back.
Well, that would be a real horror because anybody who's ever seen, there were certain hospitals and you would see a row of children in iron lungs. And I can remember that image from my childhood and just the fear, as a visceral fear for a child, particularly that to end up like that.
Tell us something more about the friendship between Jacob and Blackburn. Why has Jacob taken it upon himself to become friends with him?
Well, they've been close. The cemetery is adjacent to the store and the house that Jacob lives in. So he's kind of gotten to know Blackburn because Blackburn's family lived near there. And then Blackburn becomes the caretaker. But Jacob's very good hearted. I mean, I think he has a sense of empathy and he looks after Blackburn in his way, establishes this friendship. And I think for me, in many ways, this is a book about male friendship. It's about other things as well, but certainly that and certain sense of, as Naomi says, Blackburn would never use the word love, but he really does. He does love Jacob. I mean, he is close to Jacob and Naomi. Those are really the only two people that Blackburn, his family has moved away. He's been left there. But it's also a book that ultimately there becomes a kind of rivalry between them that tests their friendship, certain temptations. And to me, that was where, for me, the novel gets interesting because when you have these characters who are close and yet you start to have this strife, it adds to how will this be resolved?
When Blackburn first starts working at the as the caretaker at the cemetery, he is at the graveyard. He's taken under the wing by an older man, Wilkie, who is going to leave and like pass on the torch to him. And he's filled with all of this. Great. The book's very vivid on the sort of lore of the graveyard and about gravestones and things. Tell me something about the lore of the graveyard.
I wanted this story to work as a, in some ways, as a ghost story of sorts. When I was working on it, I knew that, and this is not giving away too much, because early on, I think we find it there. I had an image of a woman kneeling at night, dressed in mourning clothes, and she is looking, kneeling beside a gravestone with her name on it. And that image, my novels tend to start with a single image, and that image, you know, kind of ran through that. But I was also just fascinated. I've always kind of been fascinated with graveyards and cemeteries. I think in part because when I was a child, my grandparents' farm, and the setting of this novel is my grandparents' farm, because there, my grandparents' farm, there was a church up above it and a cemetery. And when I was a child, sometimes after a storm, the a wreath, some flowers would fall over or be blown over onto our land, and I would be sent up there to place them back on the other side of the cemetery. I wouldn't know which particular grave, but the idea was that, you know, just to put them back over there. And even as a child, I had a sense, a little, you know, that as I would put these items back through the barbed wire from our land into the cemetery, of a kind of almost being a conduit between the living and the dead. And that image had stayed with me for years, obviously, and still. And so when I started working on the novel, but also I just became fascinated with the terminology, the philthoughts, certain images, what they mean, and also the fundamentals. How would someone dig a grave? And that was interesting because in the area of Appalachia where my mother's family, when my father died, the men in the community actually dug the grave. And I found that to be a very moving ritual, an act of love. They would do this. And so I kind of wanted to bring some of the things that had come out of the culture that I knew into the novel. But also, it's just interesting. I think sometimes what can be unearthed, I'm fascinated with that as well. And some of the rituals, the idea, for instance, in this novel of how people would bring certain items that they thought the loved one might in some way miss, you know, a thimble, a pocket knife. And so I really kind of got in that. But I'm also, I think the idea that this is there's a sense that there's something mysterious, maybe even mystical going on in this graveyard.
And there's something more about the setting then. The book is set in Blowing Rock in North Carolina, which is a real place. Tell us what it would have been like in 1951.
Well, it would have been like a lot of places in the North Carolina mountains at that time. Blowing Rock would have been a place where particularly people from lower elevations, people from maybe Charlotte, Charleston, in the heat of the summer, they would come up there to escape the heat. But at the same time, most of the people who lived there would be farmers in and around that community. And Blowing Rock was, for many of these people, that would be where they would go to get clothing, articles of clothing, maybe if they needed seeds, hoes, shovels, you know, whatever. So that would be a place where they would go. But it would be a place that, particularly as you got, besides a few months in the summer, would be largely very quiet. And it would just be local people who had lived very often, as in case of my family, for generations in that area. One aspect of this book that became more and more interesting to me as I worked on the drafts was that 1951 would have been one of the last places, at least in the rural United States, where almost all communication would be face-to-face. You know, many people didn't have telephones. And I thought how much more dramatic that is than today, where so much of our communication is done on a screen or through a screen. And as I got deeper into the novel, I really wanted to emphasize that more. You know, you have these dramatic moments where someone will lie to another person face to face. So much would be revealed, not just in their words, but the way the words were said. And as I, you know, it struck me kind of interesting that in a way I'm writing about an almost obsolete or dying way of communication.
And so to finish this off, can I get you to read us a bit?
Okay, I'll do this page, yeah. In the trees, the season's last cicadas sang. Their hulls, nearly weightless, had littered the back of the cemetery for weeks. Now the insects themselves fell. Their bodies had a prettiness to them, all green at one moment, then tinged silver or blue if you turned them. Sometimes they lived a decade underground before emerging, or so some people claimed. Yesterday, Blackburn had walked down to the Ledfords' home place and found the galas ripe. He liked how apples arrived at different times. Sweet galas first, tart Granny Smith's last. Some apples had already fallen. Wasp and yellow jackets clung to the bruised fruit. The two apples Blackburn picked up had been just right, satisfying crunch, the white gleam inside bright as their taste. He'd always enjoyed this time of year, like the world was wanting to be especially generous before cold weather's hardships. A few more warm days and the air would cool, cleansed of summer's haze.
So I've been talking to Ron Rash. We've been talking about his new novel, The Caretaker, which is out in the UK from Canongate. Ron, thanks so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Well, thank you. I hope I did okay. These things are so hard.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89Up. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.